Previously on Lost.
Do you really think all this is an accident? You think we crashed on this place by coincidence? Especially this place? We were brought here for a purpose, for a reason, all of us. Each one of us was brought here for a reason.
Brought here. And who brought us here, Jeff?
The island.
They've attacked us, sabotaged us, abducted us, murdered us. We're not the only people on this island, and we all know it.
So I guess I'm out of the book club.
Two players, two sides. One is light, one is dark.
I see you in another life, brother. We have to go back. We have to go back. We have to go back. We have to go back.
We're going to need to watch that again.
Hello and welcome to The Storm, a Lost rewatch podcast for Season 3, Episode 18, D.O.C. If you were blackmailing a South Korean mob boss, how much would you extract from Sun for that information? My name's Dave Gonzalez, and I was going to say $1 million, but then I'd probably be dead. So I'm going to go with a cool $250,000.
My name is Joanna Robinson, because I'm not an idiot. I'm terrified of Sun and would not ask for a single dollar, cent, or any other denomination of money from her.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I'm apparently the worst of us, because I would ask for $10 million, mostly because, like Joanna, I'd be very scared for my safety, so I would want enough money to get as far away from Sun and her family as possible.
I'd buy, like, two cars and then, like, a garage to keep them in, and I'd probably be, like, done.
Two cars and a garage.
I gotta follow
two
cars up. And a garage. I gotta follow
be like,
up.
Oh, yeah, secrets are worth these two cars.
I gotta follow up, Dave. Which two cars are you purchasing with your Kwan blood money?
Oh, well, I have no idea. That would probably, whatever I had left after getting the garage. I guess I have to get the garage first. I haven't thought this out.
Hopefully I'm not one responsible. Of them is like one of those like Airstream vans.
Ooh, van life. Hashtag van life.
So you can at least have somewhere to sleep so that you're not sleeping on the floor of a garage.
Correct.
Well, but
correct.
See, that's the problem is I bought a two-car garage and now I have to fit an Airstream in a two-car garage. Like, then I can't have another car.
Well, just get a bigger garage. You don't even have a house.
That's what I'm saying. It's like, it's the order of when I buy things. I think I've screwed up in my mind. Anyway, this is a podcast about the TV show Lost. We've been rewatching it episode by episode, week by week, and then commenting on it about podcast by podcast. Sometimes for multiple two-parters, we do single episodes. Don't worry about it. Lost aired for 6 seasons on ABC way back when, and we're looking at it from the perspective of 2020, but this could be your first time watching Lost. Maybe not all of you watched Lost, I'm assuming, all the way through like we did back in the day. And for that case, we have split this podcast into two different sections for your enjoyment. If you don't want to be spoiled about anything that happens after Season 3, Episode 18, D.O.C., then you could stick to the first section we call The Calm. There will be no spoilers in The Calm. We will not talk about things that happen later on Lost. That is for The Storm, the second section of our podcast. If you look down at your podcasting device, you should see time codes that show you where each of those sections begin. As a matter of fact, if you just want to skip all this stuff here at the top, you could jump right to The Calm right now. It's such an easy podcast to navigate. Isn't it fantastic? Thank you so much for supporting us by listening. We hope you join us all the way through Season 6B, because, oh boy, there's stuff from here all the way through that is pretty fantastic to talk about. If you want to support us beyond just listening to the podcast and joining us on our long trek to the end, you could go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers and check out our cool bonus content that comes with subscribing at different monetary levels, from $10 I think to $5. Do we only have two levels now? Not important. If you want to know for yourself, go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers. If you subscribe at the lowest level, you get access to a podcast stream that includes a bunch of podcast episodes of a series called Feels Like the First Time, where Joanna Robinson introduces Chris Russo to pop culture movies of note that she's missed. Not always movies. Joanna, update us with Feels Like the First Time.
Yeah, so Feels Like the First Time, this ongoing thing that I've been doing with Kristen. This week we flipped the script a little bit, and Kristen got to be the knowledgeable one, and I was the, as we lovingly say, dummy, where she showed me three gay or gay-adjacent films, as I think I mentioned on last week's main podcast. So we over the weekend, we watched But I'm a Cheerleader, Lost and Delirious, and Jennifer's Body. We watched Jennifer's Body on Labor Day, and that was great. It was so good. That's been really fun. So we'll have another episode this week where Chris and I sort of break down my experience watching those movies to find out how gay I am at the end of all of this. I sent Kristen the clip of an interview that I did with an actress that I really like. And at the very end of the interview, the actress, it was like a Zoom call, and the actress goes, "You're cute." And I'm like, "You're cute." I said that to Kristen, just that clip. And I was like, "How gay is this?" She's like, "This is the gayest shit I've ever heard." So I think I'm a little gayer after these three movies. So anyway,
right. Expanding your horizons.
There you go. That's great. Pals, Feels Like the First Time. We also have coming this upcoming Sunday, you'll have another episode if you're a Patreon subscriber at the $10 level of Dave Chen and me breaking down the TV series Lovecraft Country. So we are doing our episode 5 check-in, so you can hear that. If you're a $10 subscriber, you will get that on Sunday night after episode 5 airs on HBO. So that's like, yeah, just some bonus little podcasts that we're sprinkling around for you all. Obviously, listening to us yammer is not the only way you can spend time with us. You can hang out in our Slack if you like. That's available to anyone on any level. You can email us, host@stormpodcast.com. We've got a couple great emails down in our stormy spoiler section this week on the podcast. You can go to our website, stormpodcast.com. We had a ton of live watches this Labor Day weekend. They were all on the calendar on there. So if you ever want to know what's going on, you can go check on the calendar. We've got a lot of stuff going on. You can always keep up with everything there. You can tweet at us at stormpodcast. And then you can, leave us a review. I'm going to read a review in a second, but really quickly, I'm going to announce a new thing we're doing with our Lost Live watches on our Patreon Slack, which is that we're rotating who your MC is every week. So this last week, it was my honor to lead our Slack pals through a live watch of DOC. This upcoming Saturday, Dave will be leading the live watch of The Break. That doesn't mean Neil and I won't be there. It just means that Dave is our captain now. So if you want to...
And everyone goes to The Brig. On brand.
So if you want to join Dave over there in The Brig, you can do that this Saturday in our Slack. So let's hit some reviews really quickly. And then I have one more announcement to make about an upcoming event. Okay. So this review says... I have to read it. Okay. I'm going to do my best. 5 stars. From CADS 023. This podcast has everything. Excellent host banter, an occasional dog bark, a perfect runtime if you commute in the Bay Area, genuine concern about your equilibrium. Yes, yes, yes. All right, so that was my best Stefan impression. You're welcome. Hashtag don't fall down. P.S. People need to stop hating on Joanna. She's great, and it's very sad if you let your patriarchal lizard brain get in the way of that. And 2, instead direct your critique at Dave or Neil for not speaking more, since that's what you seem to want. However, I haven't met them. I'm fairly certain they're grown-ass dudes capable of inserting themselves into the conversation when they feel like saying something. All that said, I find the dynamics /vibe/flow this podcast really great. I enjoy hanging out with them each week. So there you go.
Is that person asking for me to interrupt more? No.
They're saying if you
don't they're do saying that. If you're gonna leave the glass is half empty for Joanna. Oh no, the glass is only half full for Joanna review, you should leave the glass is half empty for both Dave and Neil review instead.
Got it. Okay.
All right. This review from Oceliac. No, I did not say that very correctly. 5 stars. And it's, I wish I could really capture the beauty of this, but essentially it says horse. Mm-hmm. I've been waiting to catch up on the pod to read a review and finally have. This pod was brought to my attention via the crossover binge mode app with Mallory Rubin. I started listening, rewatching, and instantly fell into the rhythm of the host's chemistry and personality, and of course their thorough deep dive of the show. The first time I watched Lost all the way through, my now husband talked me through the characters and the lore. My brain loses track of these things, and I'm so happy to watch again on my own with the help of Joanna, Neil, and Dave. I also find myself giggling along to inside jokes, scoffing at Jack, and rolling my eyes when the reviews complain about Joanna. She rocks, by the way. Don't tell her what she can't do. Anyway, love the concept and the conversation. Can't wait for the rest of the journey. So thank you guys for such nice things that you said about me. One last nice thing that you could do for me is on October 3rd, which is a couple Saturdays from now, we will be watching the season 3 finale of Lost. This is a biggie. It's a two-parter. It's a two-hour finale. We'll be live watching it in our Slack on October 3rd. We all of your hosts will definitely be there. It is my birthday, October 3rd. Come spend my birthday with me in our like Slack watching a truly iconic two-part season finale of a great TV show. What more could you want? From this life. So, you know, join Dave in the Brig this Saturday, and then a couple Saturdays from now, join all of us for the season 3 finale, October 3rd. Don't miss it. It's Libra season. All right. Neil, what happened on Lost this week?
Well, this episode, DOC, was directed by Frederick E.O. Toy. It was written by friends of the pod, Edward Kitsis and Adam Horowitz. It aired on April 25th, 2007, and it takes place on days 85 and 86 on the island. Remember that. We're going to do some counting. In flashbacks, we go back to the period just after Sun and Jin were married, when they were happy and considering making a family by testing out that new apartment bed. Back when Sun's biggest concern was just the blackmail plot involving Jin's past and his secret mother that we didn't know about. We'll come back to that. Back on the island, Desmond and the camping boys try to save the woman who fell from the sky. It's all going poorly until a very live Mikhail comes running out of the jungle in response to an errant flare shot from Hurley. Mikhail shows up, speaks some Italian, punctures a hole in the woman's lung, and then tries to run off with a satellite phone. Charlie is not pleased, but they let Mikhail go anyway. At beach camp, Sun has grown suspicious of Juliet and demands to know what happens to the pregnant women on the island. This leads to Juliet taking Sun to the medical station, which is, and I quote, where we brought the women to die. They take an ultrasound and deduce that the baby was conceived on the island. We're all glad to hear that it's Jin's. It all ends with our mystery woman waking up just long enough to tell Hurley that Flight 815 was not only found, but that everyone on the plane was dead. Exactly.
Dun, dun, dun.
fun fact, over the course of this episode, our new mystery friend, the parachutist with the hole in her chest, speaks 5 different languages. Spanish, Italian, Chinese, Portuguese, and English. So, you know, just a fun fact. This week's column question, we learned this week that not only does the island heal people more quickly, which we sort of knew because of all the things we've seen, but it also raises sperm count by about 5 times. Are there any other medical conditions that this island could cure that you think would be interesting? I will start with an example. I think that the island also cures sunburn. Because everyone is outside all the time and everyone's skin is still perfect. So the island also cures sunburn. Dave, do you have any ideas for other medical conditions that the island cures?
I'm going to say that the island cures all sleep conditions. So everyone falls into a deep sleep that may or may not have dreams, but it's not like you're getting the restless leg syndrome, or you have some sleep apnea, or you're sleepwalking. if those things occur, that's the island's influence. Everyone's sleep so conditions are cured.
No more need for Ambien on the island.
Exactly.
Everyone's just perfect sleep all the time.
It's got to be great.
All right. Joanna, any
well, so is that like if or has? Because like, wait, Dave, are you saying it would be nice if, or you feel like it has cured everyone's sleep condition?
I feel like it has.
I feel like, here's my counter argument to that. I think like running around in the sun and the surf and climbing trees and getting mangoes and hunting boar and bushwhacking and running from smoke monsters, that's nature's Ambien. You sleep real good. If you're living,
I'm sure the A team sleeps like babies, but there's a whole bunch of people who are just moving tarps from one place to another, as far as I can tell.
Scott Steve is just loafing around on a pile of tarps day in, day out.
Yeah. Bernard's somewhere without a Phil Collins cassette, and like, what is he doing? I have no idea.
Dental work. All right. So I would say, I'm going to say along the lines of Neil's comment about sunburn, I'm going to say like, oily scalp, dandruffy scalp, split ends. Everyone's hair looks great, and they shouldn't because they blew up their shower. So I don't know how everyone's hair looks so good.
So because the island emits, this is my theory, the island emits something into the water that basically puts conditioner in the seawater.
Yeah.
So that when they wash their hair in the sea, it comes out somehow better than it would if it was just washing your hair with salt water.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Like, that's why they abandoned the caves, is because they're like, the one thing we had going here was showers, but these showers are like not working. They don't have the magic seawater.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Juliet's hair is, she's got like some nice beachy wave happening now that she's left Otherton. So, you know.
Goes back to the recorder. Mm-hmm. Ben, the beach, I've learned something about the beaches and hair. It's very important.
My hair looks awesome. I'm going to stay here and eat oatmeal with Jack. Thanks. Bye.
Oh, yeah, the magic seawater would also probably clean the dishes, oatmeal off dishes at night with, like, little effort.
Night dishes deserve a quiet night. Yeah, that'd be great.
But that was last episode. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about DOC, mm-hmm. because the flashback here, I actually do like this sun flashback because it complicates the Sun-Jin pre-island relationship in an interesting way. I want to know with you guys, because what we sort of have at the end of this flashback is it takes place before Bloody Fist-Jin is washing his hands in a sink with Sun sort of being surprised at this, but ties her into that by basically taking out this loan that her father decides Jin is responsible for. Does this bring them closer together, or does this make Sun kind of not the best supportive character?
What?
I mean, I definitely think it's the show going back to implicate Sun in Jin's debt. You know, because like we've seen the storyline where Jin is, you know, indebted to her father. And I think up until this point, always assumed that it was just, that's just sort of how it worked.
The price of him, you know, marrying, like, Sun.
You're in the family, you got to just be part of the gang. But to then bring it back and sort of recontextualize it as something Sun did is an interesting choice.
I mean, yeah, that's what I'm trying to say is, like, does that make it, like, does that implicate both of them in being more trapped, or did we not necessarily have to involve Sun in this secret deal to sort of trap Jin?
I don't think we need to do that. There are enough secrets running around in this episode. The fact that she knows that his mom's alive, the fact that she met his dad and he doesn't know that she met his dad, like all that sort of stuff. Like, she has so many secrets going on. But I think it is a further deepening of Sun as like someone you shouldn't mess with.
Yes.
Which I definitely like, because I think I know when we met Sun, she had this secret of she's learning English, or she's learned English and Jin doesn't know it. But I think the more we dig into their flashbacks, and I don't think it's a spoiler to say, I mean, we've implied this already on the show, that we're sort of reaching the end of them running back over the same material again and again and again. So, like, I think this is the last Sun and Jin flashback that deals with this specific time in their lives. They're around their marriage, or around their wedding. And so I think they're running a little low on content. I like the retcon of her meeting Jin's dad, because it means we get that lovely scene with Jin's dad. And I think it's great. I love like her being kind of a badass to Jin's mom, but I agree. I just don't think we needed, like this other element of what happens with, her awful father.
It's great for Sun. I just don't like what it does for the Sun and Jin relationship, because just by nature of this was written after season one, Sun and Jin, like already I feel much better about them on the island than I do off the island. So to have that sort of like reminder that, first of all, I didn't like Jin really, cause he was very abrasive in season one, and then to now be like, oh, so also at that time period I could have not liked Sun, felt weird, just in terms of the two of them. The story of the relationship in the text of the episode tells me to be really happy they're together and that they've, you know, had a, you know, successful conception on the island. And that Sun doesn't have to worry about our old smooth boy Jai Li anymore, and can live her life sort of like guilt free. But I think it has.
Yeah, she just has to worry about her death. That's all.
Well,
don't worry about that pesky extramarital affair.
That's kind of pushed to subtext by the way the episode ends, and so I think is the, you know, implication that, you know, she basically put Jin in direct service to her father.
Can I ask you a question? Is your interpretation that Sun understands the full implication of what her dad is saying about the strings attached to this money?
It's hard not to think of it that way, because she does that right after explaining to her father that she has been watching him her whole life and is very aware of what he is. So it's hard to imagine a situation in which Sun goes through with taking the $100,000 from her father after he says that, and her not to think that that means bad, you know, potentially bad things for Jin. So it does sort of make the initial story that we get from them a little weirder, because, you know, the line at the beginning is, or in season one, you know, the mistrust. The reason why Sun learns English is because she's trying to get away from Jin, because he's sort of changed, right? He's become this monstrous other person. So here we are in season three, and we're sort of retconning that a little bit. We're recontextualizing it, I guess, or going deeper on that to find out that it was something that Sun did that sort of set that in motion. And it is, I mean, it would be hard. It's like I said, it's just hard to imagine that she didn't have some idea that that's what was going to happen with Jin. I mean, you know, they're also still trying to like work it out now that they're on the island. I mean, so much has happened, I guess, but in that, just in the flashback, it's very interesting to me that, that they build in this moment for Sun where she basically sets up Jin's debt.
Yeah, it changes the tenor of the moment where she decides, you know, not to leave him. But not in a it doesn't matter, because we had that moment. So if I'm revisiting that moment with a different complication, it kind of doesn't matter if I like it more or not.
Yeah.
It is just, you know, it's more complicated, like I think a lot of things in, you know, life are, if you like look at them. I'm gonna walk that back.
Yeah.
Just because I didn't like it doesn't mean it's bad. I want to clarify that. I just, you know, I in a perfect world I'd be rooting for Sun and Jin, because they're main characters on the show that I like, and sometimes characters you like make decisions you don't like. Any conversations probably about Black Sails that we'll ever have. Yeah, I like the flashback as a complication, and then I like the Sun and Juliet story, which I think is a lot more of a reassertion of Sun's, I think ever since she's been a product of the Charlie Sawyer, sort of fake, abduction, Sun has been, oh, never mind. I guess we're slowly seeing the more confident Sun that came back from the other side of the island assert herself more. And I like that. And I like that Juliet sees that once and then learns how to respect it and still get what she wants. The whole tightrope that Juliet has to walk during this episode, where I know she has an ulterior motive because she's Juliet, but I'm trying to see past all of her speeches to Sun, which are very good speeches about, you know, wanting to give good news and very good blunt explanations about hidden rooms. I think it all works really well up until the end, where I think Sun's a little bit too happy and I wouldn't let Juliet go back into that hatch alone. But by that point, the episode has me. So I'm good on flashback and a story this week. Joanna.
Mm-hmm.
Juliet this week.
Yeah.
Real smooth.
Great. What a smooth boy she is. Yeah.
When do you think Juliet has the situation under control? Am I right that she is accosted by Sun first, or do you think this has been a Juliet plan for much longer? She was just biding her time.
Well, she's there to info gather on Sun and, as we find out, Kate. So that's her mission, her directive. So she's trying to figure out the best way to do it. And it does seem like Sun attacks. It's not like she's out of control. It's just like she starts this episode on the back foot a bit. But I would never call, at least thus far, I don't think we've seen Juliet fully out of control. Maybe when she burned her hand on those muffins. I feel like she's just always doing calculations in her head of like, what does this situation need now? What does this situation need now? And I think you're right that she is like learning to take the measure of Sun and maybe underestimated her a bit. Who she is, but yeah.
Do you think she sent Jack to check on Sun in the first place, knowing that Sun and Kate would commiserate and those are the two people she needs to draw into her web?
I don't know. You're always like assuming people are playing 9 levels of chess, and maybe they are. Maybe she is Littlefinger, but I don't know. I think she's only playing 3 levels of chess. She might have been like, hey, Jack, you might want to check on Sun. Like, I can see her saying that over a bowl of night oatmeal, but like, I don't know that she's like, and then of course, Sun will, that's a Ben move. That's not really a Juliet move to be like, and then Sun, of course, will talk to Kate, and I've got to talk to Kate, and like, blah, blah. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That's what Maybe. I think. Is that how you run your life? I think I've asked you this before. do you run your life in such a way where you're like thinking nine steps down the interaction ladder?
Would aspire to if I was in the situation that Juliet was in, which seems to be at any given point, camping boys come back and Charlie's like, well, she's an other, and then her situation basically depends on if Jack can save her. So I would be playing everybody.
I don't know if you heard, but she's under Jack's protection. So she's fine.
Oh, yeah.
No, but I
Very
do. I mean,
consistent and trustworthy Jack.
I like the turn of the Sun-Juliet relationship in this episode, despite the fact that Juliet is, yes, playing her the whole time. I like watching Juliet figure out how she has to approach different people. And I like watching Sun be able to be that emotionally vulnerable with Juliet, even if Juliet is not someone she probably should be trusting. I like watching her you know, giving her that person to play off of resulted in just some like really, really exquisite acting. I just thought this was a really incredible episode for Sun. I think maybe, maybe her strongest episode of the series. This or one other is a candidate coming up, but this is really high up on the list for me. And I think Sun is an underutilized character overall in Lost. And I think she gets left out of some conversations when we talk about like some of the top performers on the show. But I think it's because sometimes the writers lacked imagination in terms of like unhooking her story from Jin's story, or not. But whenever she's given the opportunity to do something like this, you know, because this is something, this is large. She has like, what, a scene with Jin in this episode? So this is largely her, you know, interacting with other people, and it's all just like the stuff with his mom, the stuff with his dad, the stuff with Juliet. It's all just incredibly strong. I love this episode for her.
I forgot to mention as we were talking about the flashback that yes, the Juliet and Sun pairing rules. Like the on island stuff in this episode is, I agree with Joanna, some of my best. I think, you know, maybe the flashback's a little more complicated than it needed to be, but like if it means that we get the conversation with Jin's father and we get that badass moment where Sun tells Jin's mother off at the end, it's all worth it. Cause she just, you know, the on island stuff's so good and Yunjin Kim is great.
She's fantastic.
Yeah. And it's just, and the other thing I wrote in the notes is like Juliet's bedside manner.
Yeah.
And this is something that I found interesting, especially as we give Jack a lot of a really hard time, I guess, as a character about the way he like barks at people a lot. Juliet's bedside manner is just magnificent.
Well, like this, it is.
She's just so like empathetic and kind. And you're like it would be easy to forget if you were in that moment with Juliet that she was, you know,
another,
an outsider from the camp or the other, you know? Yeah.
No, we were talking about that in the live watch. So like, because it starts out a little rough at first in this episode. Mm-hmm. And people are like, I don't know who I'd rather have, Jack or Juliet. And then like, but once they're like in the medical hatch, like the bedside manner is really shining.
You're just like, oh, now I know why Richard wanted to give her a whole glass of orange juice. She's really good at this.
Lewd juice. Yeah, it's great.
Extremely competent.
Yeah, she's really good. So, Juliet, she's very good. Yeah.
Both Juliet and Jack would have said, this is where we bring the women to die. I feel like that's a sentence that comes out of both of them. but with Juliet, it somehow seems like, oh, she's telling me a truth. Whereas with Jack, it'd be like, man, Jack, you didn't...
Pick your moment.
Yeah, you didn't have to. No one asked you.
Yeah. But it's just like, you know, we talked about Catch-22 is the title of last week's episode, but this is also a classic Catch-22. I mean, like, the math doesn't actually fully work out for the DOC to be such a question mark for Sun, because, like, if you do the walk backwards math, like this is Jin and Sun having sex like pretty immediately when they get to the island. And I don't know if you remember Jin and Sun when they immediately got to the island, but he was like, button your sweater.
To the plane.
He's like, button your sweater. So I don't know how much they were getting down. Obviously, later, famously, we know that Jin and Sun took advantage of their privacy tarp, but so it doesn't really work, but it is like really, I think it's a really clever thing where it's like, if you know, if you had if you conceived this baby before you got to the island, it means this baby is your lover's baby and you're going to have to tell your husband that, and that's going to be really hard, especially since you've done so much work to repair your relationship. And if your baby was conceived on the island, then you are in mortal danger. No winning for you, son. Here we go. You know what I mean? And I think that's a clever turn of the screw there.
And a really clever moment for the writer's room where now we have two characters that have death sort of hanging over them. We have Sun that we can add to the Charlie situation.
Yeah. One of, one of our listeners in Live Watch, who's a commie, was like, I was 0% invested in anyone getting off this island until this episode. And now I'm like, Sun has to get off before she has her baby. Because,
well, yeah, and I mean, I feel like we've even mentioned it in the past couple podcast episodes, and the show calls attention to it every once in a while, where you get into this season three run and people are like, wait, why isn't anyone trying to get off the island? Why did they build a galley, you know? And this twist in the plot creates urgency
right
toward the end of the season, which is great.
Yeah.
And it's a character that we, you know, I mean, we still like Sun. She's, you know, she's had her secrets, but we're definitely rooting for Sun. Like, I'm also still definitely rooting for Jin. Like, the moment where Jin and Mikhail have their little altercation and looks like Mikhail's about to strangle Jin against a tree. I remember being like, oh my God, no. Like, don't kill Jin before he finds out.
I mean,
he's really the father.
I don't want Jin to die, obviously. I'm a big Jin fan. I love Jin. But I gotta be honest with you guys. Every time I rewatch Lost, I love Mikhail more. And so if you like had one guillotine and you told me either Jin or Mikhail had to have their heads chopped off, I can't promise you I wouldn't vote for the slippery Russian. Like, I just really like him, and I don't...
Charlie would be so disappointed.
Would be very disappointed.
I crave Charlie's disappointment.
If you had to kill one person in the party, kill Charlie. It's already fated.
Yeah. Oh, just be like, oh no, that's an easy choice. But I'm just saying, this is the hard choice, Jin or Mikhail, and I'm saying... I think I might choose Mikhail. I love him. Were you not thrilled to see him show back up? Like, just running, running out of the jungle, blood crusted down his face? You know.
I'm glad the blood crusted exists, because it gets two things out of the way, seemingly, for people who are looking for Island of Mystery things. One is... not like a different, like, identical guy with an eye patch in some sort of weird clone universe.
Mikhail's twin Vladimir?
With eye patch on other side. And then two is this definitely, this and his joke about having already died once this week means that this isn't some sort of weird future or past Mikhail. This is the one that got all bloody... when Locke pushed him into the sound barrier, which seemed like a villainous thing to do at the time.
We're not talking
about
it.
And still is.
Well, okay, so...
yeah, if you don't.
I guess then what we're supposed to assume about what happened to Mikhail after John antagonized him is that... it's just that his explanation of the island, where it's just like, oh, well, the island's just super heal-y. It'll just heal anything. Which I don't... think is entirely does that that I mean, wouldn't Boone still be alive if that was entirely true?
I mean, what's a little brain bleed between friends? Does bleeding out of your ear like mean you're definitely dead?
No, I mean, I think you can, like, your eardrums can burst. So,
and his hearing's shot, so I think, you know, I think he...
I'm a little disappointed in our away team that they didn't, like, check him before they walked away.
Wasn't his body missing?
Was it?
I'm pretty sure his body goes missing in that episode. Like, they look back and his body's gone. Did I make that up? Maybe that was just wishful thinking. Okay.
They could have just checked his pulse before they walked away.
That sounds like something I would do. I would just make up that Mikhail has vanishing properties.
Well, because I think...
but I mean, he's back, and that's all that matters.
Now that we're, you know, at this point where he's shown back up again, unlike the Lostopedia thing, there's like a... it was under the... bloopers, but they're like made a note that it's been moved out of the bloopers into the trivia section, that you could see the actor breathing, which
they thought
was like a take thing, but now they can't prove, because Mikhail's here, whether that was a bad take or if he was supposed to be breathing. Good old seemingly immortal characters, which I think Joanna brings up our first ever calm email prompt.
Oh, yeah. So we're going to do a new thing, because we want you commies to, like, email us, as well as the people who are hanging out in the storm. So we are going to give you little, like, email prompts. If you want to email us, hostthestormpodcast.com, we would love to get your commie emails. This is, like, kind of bring back the spirit of, like, theorizing and speculating. There's no wrong guesses. we support you in your theories, but we just want you to have like the full Lost experience and play along. So, our prompt is, I can't find it in our notes, so I'm just going to remember it, which is, what would it take to kill Mikhail? Is that what we came up with?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I don't know where it went either, but that's the correct question.
Mikhail, seemingly immortal Russian being, beautiful eye patch man who can perform basic surgery. I mean, like, he did a pretty good job on the mystery lady, right? Like,
I mean, if he ever gets impaled by a tree, he's going to be able to treat himself pretty easily.
I feel like Jack would have tried to amputate something off that lady before he, like, actually helped her. But Mikhail did some, like, good, like, you know, what do you call it? What is it
triage?
Called? Like, well, yeah, triage is a fancy word, but I was going to go with like what? Battlefield medicine. That's what I want to say. Like, yeah, triage. I just love Mikhail. He is like my number one right now on the show. And I would like to hear from you what you think it would take to kill him and who would do the killing. I guess is our bloodthirsty question this week for you commies. Mm-hmm. We'd love
probably
to hear.
Charlie. The easiest answer to this email. Here you go, listeners. I'm going to help you.
Why would you do that? Let them do it. No one asked you, Dave.
Louder sonic fence is what I was going to say. That's
also,
the
you might be tempted to answer this question in our Slack, and you could do that. But like, I'm not going to read those. I will read an email that you sent, though. So hostthestormpodcast.com if you have some thoughts on what it would take to kill Mikhail. I started calling him Rasputin because, as you may or may not know, Rasputin was also famously hard to kill. So Mikhail, Rasputin, whatever you want to call him.
I think I learned that through history and then like 2 years later through Hellboy. And sadly, I think it's the Hellboy one that stuck.
Not Anastasia?
Yeah, sadly, no.
Okay. Anyway, so Mikhail, what can kill Mikhail?
What can kill Mikhail? Speaking of favorite things we like to talk about in this podcast with Lost, we like to point out lots of bad dads, but I forgot to circle back to the flashback that point out a bad mom.
We get a bad mom and a good dad. I would say Jin's dad is by far the best dad we've seen in this show.
Absolutely.
So far. You know, we're rooting for Jin to follow in his footsteps as a good dad. But bad mom, for this is our first bad mom.
Surely someone else has had a bad mom. Kate's mom, I'm not a huge fan of.
Kate's mom, but you know, that's sort of.
I mean, it's understandable. I'm just not a huge fan of her.
The moms are usually kind of like weak, like Charlie's mom's a little weak. Like, you got to have a lot of weak moms to enable these bad dads. You know what I mean? So, like,
sure.
Boone's mom sucks.
Okay.
Remember how like cut off Shannon was gonna get a job in New York.
Oh yeah, that's right.
At an apartment.
And then Boone's mom cut her off. Ugh, the worst. Anyway, I think this is the worst mom though. It's good old
extortion.
Jin's mom.
Straight up, he might have come out of me, but he wasn't my son. And then away she walks.
And I'll ask you the same question I asked some of our listeners in Slack, which is, do you think son's dad is the worst dad?
Ooh, no, I don't know. I mean, he's bad.
I mean, I feel like I've seen his narrative in other
John
places.
Locke's father pushed him out of a
there you go
like 10-story window.
Yeah. That's the answer they came up with. They're like, back. Nope. I'm running for Anthony Cooper. I was like, oh yeah,
Anthony Cooper, still the worst dad.
Still number one. Jin's dad,
Christian Shepherd's like sitting in the background like drinking.
Oh no, Christian's
just quietly staying out of the way of this conversation.
Christian Shepherd is fully in the middle of our ranking, but like, he's complicated. It's complicated with Christian Shepherd, but Jin's dad, number one. Oh my god, when Son asks him, why didn't you come to the wedding, and he's like, I think my son's embarrassed, but he's not like he's not mad about it, he's just like nice about it. Oh my god, I started crying.
He's just like, oh, it's fine. Ugh. It's fine.
And really, he's fine. Just like, you're so beautiful. And you're just like, oh no, Jin's dad.
I love the little moment. This is a little, I don't know if this was written this way or if this is a performance thing where he like wipes his hand off before he like touches her face. Like this idea that of these like really ingrained classist things where he's like, let me, you know, clean my hand before I touch this beautiful woman's face. But also just such a sweet moment, you know, where he's like meeting his daughter-in-law for the first, and as far as we know so far, only time, you know?
And the, the interesting parallel, the parallel of him being like, I wasn't even sure if Jin was mine, but like I raised him, he's mine. And, you know, and then you're left to wonder, like, would Jin, cause he's, he asked Sun.
Would Jin do the same for Jai Li, for Smooth Boys Baby?
Yeah, he asked Sun, and then she was like, no, I swear to you, it's your son or your child. That was before she knew. But she, like, said it was. But, like, I'd like to believe that Jin would behave as his father did. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. I think I guess, do you think if the if Juliet's calculation went the other way, do you think Sun would have told Jin? I think at this point, I think so, on the island.
I don't know. She's got so many depths.
Sun, that's, I think that's what makes Sun and Juliet such a good pairing, is because Juliet is the character that we're very actively don't know what she's doing or thinking at all times. And Sun is starting to become one of those characters where it's like, there's more to Sun. And she is not to be underestimated by anyone.
Oh, Sun. I feel like I've said my bit on Sun, but we should circle back a little bit to the mystery of the parachutist,
the camping boys,
the polyglot parachutist and the camping boys
and the camping boys. Man, that sounds like a Hardy Boys mystery I want to read.
But what is this, if not a Hardy Boys mystery in the jungle?
that is true.
This sequence.
Mikhail showing up gets sort of, you know, solves them, like, solves one of their problems, like Joanna said, with the quick field medic sucking chest wound to fix a collapsed lung maneuver, and then tries to sneak away with the phone. And Desmond's really into keeping his word against Charlie being very anti-other. This is an interesting interaction, I think, to place here in the series. Why do we think it's here? Why is it important that Desmond keep his word to the others at this point?
I don't know the answer to your question or why you're asking.
Well, I think, okay, I can take a crack at this
All
one.
Right.
As we're seeing, as season three is sort of reaching its apex or headed toward its apex, you know, the others are coming back into focus as an enemy. So any way in which the show can complicate the relationship between the others and our survivors, of which Desmond, I guess, is now part, right? Where Desmond is fully on the beach camp team. Juliet seems to be in between. So I think this idea that there's some sort of confrontation coming, you know, we still don't know what Ben's going to do when he comes back. We don't quite know what happened to John yet, but it does feel like we're building toward a moment where, like, people are going to have to decide, is it, you know, are the others bad or good, you know? It's interesting that Desmond, you know, cause Desmond, I think, is continuing in this episode to, like, do things for his own reasons. And those reasons are all Penny. So it complicates things if, you know, Desmond, isn't all the way on Team Survivor, right? Is that where you're going with that? Like, sort of complicates things that Desmond's willing to work with Mikhail on this. Like, it's because he wants to get the answer about Penny.
I mean,
it's not anything to do with the beach camp survive, you know, like the whole ideological war between the others and the beach camp.
Yeah, yeah. I definitely think it says something about Desmond. It could be that, I guess the weird thing for me and the way I phrase the question is, why is this here? It's like the last episode was sort of about, like, can we trust Desmond? Can Charlie trust Desmond? is this more about Desmond and Charlie and less about some sort of deal with the others? Like, the way Desmond turns to Charlie, he's like, I gave you my word. Didn't he also give Charlie his word? He's, like, gonna try to help him or something? Like, is it about Desmond reaffirming something to Charlie? Or is it just about reminding us that Charlie's really anti-other? I think it could be either way. It's just a kind of confusing thing to be placed at this moment in the series as a conflict for me, I think.
I mean, I don't think it's confusing for Charlie to be, like, very anti-other. He is...
It's very xenophobic.
Even though Desmond's right about the fact that Charlie's killed more of them, although that's not entirely true either, so... Because Ethan definitely killed Steve or Scott or whatever. He broke all the bones in his
body. Every bone in his body. Plus, they...
So, like, it's like this weird moment where, like, Desmond's like, yeah, you guys are just as bad. And it's like, well, that's not true.
I mean, I'm always ready to knock Charlie for whatever I can. But let's just say in this instance, Ethan did string him up and leave him hanging. So, I mean, sure, he paid Ethan back for that. But, like, you know, that's some real trauma. I don't know. For me, what always seems important to remember about Desmond is, like, when we're talking about communities versus the individual, right? Desmond might have made some friends on this beach, and he might be kind of, you know, he's like, he's got some kind of connection with Charlie and blah, blah. But let's be very clear that Desmond's number one priority is always going to be what's going to get me home to Penny. That's Desmond's motivation. And so, like, the rest of the team, you know, the rest of the team, you see them sort of slowly seed their individualist needs for the greater good. Like, for example, I would say Sawyer starts and you think he's a wholly selfish creature, but then he, like, jumps off the raft after Walt, you know what I mean, or whatever, you know, like you see Sawyer put himself on the line for others in a way that you didn't think he was capable of when you first met him. And so slowly this collection of individuals, these selfish, flawed individuals who had their own little tribes, like Sun and Jin were their own little tribe, and Michael and Walt were their own little tribe, and Shannon and Boone and stuff like that, you see them slowly form this larger tribe. And I guess what's just clear about Desmond is that he's still, in his own mind, the tribe is him and Penny, and, like, he might hang out with these other people, but it's not that they're not his tribe, you know. Does that answer any question? I don't know if that's...
I mean, I think we all three came up with very good answers to that scene. I can't prove any one of us has a better answer than the other one, which is, I think, good. I mean, it's interesting. That's why I sort of brought it up. It seemed like a weird position to place at this point in the narrative, but I do think we all hit upon very true tensions that they want to bring up as they skid into the back half of this season. And, well, I guess skid is the wrong word. We're ramping up into a whole bunch of climactic stuff. So,
what I will say is that whether or not Charlie's distrust of the others is effective as a strategy, or Desmond's sort of Penny focus is effective strategy, Hurley, on the other hand, very effective at all times because he's very chill. Fires the flare gun accidentally. That gets Mikhail. I assume that's why Mikhail came running. And then later, he's just chilling out, playing around with the phone, and he learns all kinds of important information from our... What do we call her? Polyglot parachutist.
Polyglot parachutist.
So sometimes the answer is just be chill.
Yeah. Matter of fact, we got our jungle of mystery moment from polyglot parachutist, who said they found the plane. There were no survivors. They were all dead. Lost.
Love that as a meta commentary. Because everybody on the island is dead theory was, like, we talked about this in season one, right? As, like,
very early theory,
this fan theories of the many lost fan theories, everybody died in the plane crash was, like, always way up there. And so for them to, like, just drop that in is great. It's just great. I don't even care if it's true. It's great.
To weave it in. The show does sort of feel like it's talking to people who are watching the show occasionally this season, but I don't dislike it. I think it's done in a lot better way with like things like expose than it was with some of the more embedded mystery clues that still have not given us answers from season two, where it's like the illusion of there being some sort of deep mystery that isn't. I kind of feel like these little callbacks and hints are much more thrilling, but that might also be a product of a rewatch, because I can imagine being in the middle of this the first time it's airing, there's probably like 100 questions that I'm forgetting to ask about, like, you know, did Mikhail come from wherever, you know, Locke's been? You know, was the Desmond Charlie moment to like set up, you know, Charlie and Mikhail having like a moment later, or Desmond having to choose between Charlie's life and keeping his word? It's a whole bunch of odd rewatch problems that happen at the end of season three, but I'm enjoying as we go through it. Let's keep going with some corners. Joanna, how's Desmond's shirt doing this week?
Oh, it's gaping, but it's still holding on. I believe we've reached DEFCON 3 to 4 buttons on the bottom. You know, so we have yet to go to full red alert, which is all buttons open. We'll see.
I bet he would have if he had to run back to camp to get Jack to an 8-hour run as fast as he could. He'd be like, first step, all buttons undone.
One of our listeners is like, I love how Desmond thinks he's the Gendry of the island. I can do it. I can do the run. It's fine.
All right. Well, but here's another theory, though. If in the last episode, Desmond took off the helmet from the parachutist and it was Penny, and they found that Penny had been stabbed by a branch, Desmond would have torn his shirt all the way off, picked up Penny, and ran 8 miles back to Jack.
A fact.
Truth. All right. Do we have a Giacchino corner this week, Neil?
We do. There's two good ones from the season three soundtrack in this episode. One is called Russian the Russian.
Which is
statement on the other's action motif. And then there is one called Deadly Fertility.
Yikes.
Which is a variation on Sun and Jin's theme, which, yeah, you know, I like Russian the Russian better.
Well,
if we have to pick one.
Something I wanted to say is, like, I mentioned last week or a couple weeks ago, whenever we were talking about fertility as, like, sort of a plot twist on the island, how I was like, this is actually a really serious thing for women to have to deal with and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And I just thought that this episode did the best of any I've seen so far dealing with the toll that it took on Sun, like the question mm-hmm. of their fertility and their marriage and stuff like that. And so, I don't know. I thought there was some good stuff on that theme in this week's episode.
Well, and more of the toll it also took on Juliet having to, like, put all of these women through horrible news and try to nurse them through death. Yeah, I think it worked out okay. But, mm-hmm. you know, those Giacchino, we've got to have those snappy titles.
Mm.
Our Henry Gale Memorial Obviously Alive Award, we do have run this week. After Mikhail's sucking chest wounds, our polyglot parachutist, man, the inside jokes of this episode are going to be very tongue twistery. She speaks some Portuguese that Mikhail says, Desmond says, what did she say? And Mikhail says, our Memorial Obviously Alive Award, thank you. She said, thank you for helping me.
Now do it in a Scottish and Russian accent.
No.
He does say, thank you.
Thank you.
She says, thank you. Thank you for helping me.
She actually, do we get to say what she actually says?
No, I don't think we should yet.
No.
Okay.
It's a spoiler if you know Portuguese.
Yes, that's true. It's a spoiler if you know Portuguese. This was.
So, like, shout out to all our Portuguese listeners who are like, I know something.
Brazil!
Occasionally when I'm catching up on lost episodes, I like start the episode as I'm like, you know, getting a beer, getting some food, or like letting the ice cream thaw a little bit so I don't send it flying when I try to scoop it out. And, you know, I'm kind of wandering around. You cannot do that for Sun and Jin episodes with polyglot parachutists. Everything's subtitled and it does not work out. You got to either know all the languages like the parachutist or keep your eyes on the screen. Very important.
Or Mikhail, apparently.
Or Mikhail.
He speaks a lot of them.
Mikhail might speak every language, right? You don't know that he doesn't.
So attractive.
He's a magic man. Joanna, speaking of Mikhail the magic man, does he show up in this week's Jungle of Kistery poll?
You know he does. All right, so let's talk about last week. So Jungle Kistery, right, is this poll we run every week where we're like people who should be kissing, or like people and inanimate objects, or like people and concepts. I don't know. It's very loose. Jungle of Kistery is what we call it, but it doesn't have to actually be literally smooching. Anyway, we ran this poll last week for Catch-22, and we thought it was a foregone conclusion.
Not all of us. Some of us were rooting for...
No, I didn't say I was rooting, wasn't rooting for it. I just said, I just thought there was no hope. Oh,
I had hope.
I whipped the votes on my personal Twitter for this other candidate who won, but I didn't think it was going to work. Anyway, you know, it's a Desmond episode. Penny's in it. Usually that means Desmond and Penny win the poll, no question. But here's what happened this week, guys. Jack and Sawyer, 11.5% of the vote. No one cared about their ping pong game as much as I did, apparently.
Yeah, tough break.
Sawyer and Kate, who literally bone in this episode, 16.3% of the vote. People, once again, heterosexuality is not the winner. Desmond and Penny, 29.8% of the vote. And they were ahead for a while. They were winning for a while. But then here he comes. It's Jin. It's a flashlight. It's a ghost story. It's Jin and the concept of camping. A whopping 42.5%. I've never seen such an Kistery upset in my life. And here's the lesson, folks. You might think, there's no way your candidate is going to lose an election, but every vote counts. So vote this November.
Gin and camping. 2020.
Vote for gin and camping.
Nothing is ever a sure thing, okay? So vote. All right.
I'm so happy for gin and camping.
Oh, I'm thrilled. Camping is so lucky to have gin. Smooch it. All right. So this week, we've got a few things. We've got Sun and... Dave's boyfriend, smooth boy Jai Lee. He doesn't show up in the episode, but we know they smooched at one point. So Phil just wanted
man
to
size baby.
Resurrect.
Make a baby size baby.
Resurrect the specter of Jai Lee, who may or may not have been murdered by Sun. No, so Sun and Jai Lee. That's one. Jin and Jin's dad, and this is from Ivan, and it was like he said like more of a hugstery. It's more of a like a, you know, he just wanted Jin and Jin's dad to have like a nice moment.
Or like a moment where Jin's dad kisses Jin on the forehead.
Yeah.
Tells him he's proud of him.
Yeah. So
not on Lost. This is not, good dads aren't getting their due on Lost. No.
But we would love to see it. And then of course, let's rush in the Russian. We've got Mikhail and Charlie. This is from Melissa, and you might remember that like Mikhail and Charlie do some real close talking. and Mikhail is like really snarky with Charlie, which is always fun to watch. So Mikhail and Charlie, it's good stuff. That's from Melissa. But I'm here for Cindy's nomination personally, which is Mikhail and the satellite phone he almost got away with.
Oh.
He tucked it down his jumpsuit.
He didn't try.
He's so slippery. I love him always. Love you, Mikhail. Never count him out. He's always coming back. It's Mikhail. So, yeah, vote your conscience over on our Twitter feed later this week.
And before we take a break, we're going to do our official podcast check-in. There was an official Lost podcast that was airing along with the series where showrunners Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse would answer viewer questions. At this point, I think they've just finished shooting the finale of Season 3 and are in editing of Season 3, and they're very slap-happy with the questions. But here we go. I'll be reading Carlton Cuse, and you'll be reading Damon Lindelof. Carlton, reading. Will you at some point revisit the psychic's predictions about Claire's baby and Walt's seeming ability to either manipulate or predict future events? More, do the other's obsession with children and pregnancy go beyond the apparent inability of women to successfully bear children on the island? Are they interested in, for lack of a better expression, children with special abilities? Would there be a better expression than children with special abilities?
Is that your question or theirs?
That's my question about why doesn't he just say, why are they interested in children with special abilities? I mean...
Which is the title of your fourth album.
Which would be the better expression? This is from Alex, although he calls himself Xander DG.
Could be Alexander.
Yeah, but you don't just choose one or the other if you're Alexander. Don't you either go by Xander or Alex?
No, because no one posts under the name from Frank, you know? They all have to have fancy Spamalot or Catwoman Roses or Magic Rabbits or Oceanic Tornado. Who would read a question from Cliff?
You're never going to answer any of these questions.
I'll answer all of these.
Something? Tangential?
I'll answer all those questions.
Okay.
First question was...
Psychic. Revisit the psychic's prediction about Claire's baby and Walt's seeming ability to either predict or manipulate future events.
Yes, we will.
Okay, that's good. More, do the others' obsession with children go beyond the apparent inability of women to successfully bear children on the island?
Yes.
Are they interested in, for lack of a better expression, children with special abilities?
Yes.
Well, we have Miss Clue already sort of showed us that.
Yeah.
She was asking an awful lot of questions that you wouldn't find on your average PSAT test.
I mean, I think they want... That's why the others targeted Walt. They really went out of their way to get him.
Yeah.
And I think it was sort of on their radar. There might, in fact, you know... be some hint that in episodes to come, as far as Walt's abilities, but we haven't seen Michael or Walt all season long.
No, that's really kind of frustrating to me.
Well, welcome to Lost, my friend.
And end scene. They're having some fun over there in podcast land.
Things got a little loose there at the end of season three.
Things got a little loose. Well, as somebody who's doing a podcast about season three of Lost, I totally get what they're feeling. And we will stumble into the storm to get loose right after this.
Okay, let me start by asking you boys a quick question.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
We're still in a pandemic quarantine, despite mm-hmm. what you might have heard elsewhere.
Right.
Could there possibly be anything in your lives interfering with your happiness or preventing you from achieving your goals?
Joanna, yesterday it was 98 degrees here. As we're recording this right now, there's an inch of snow and it's still snowing. I'm having lots of trouble just with environment, let alone current events.
Yes, it's true. Take your pick. There's a lot of options as to what might be interfering with one's happiness right now in 2020. And so we are thrilled on The Storm to bring you a possible solution. It is BetterHelp. That's H-E-L-P. BetterHelp is an online therapy service, and I am a huge fan of the service. I actually now know when we started these ads, I knew no one who was actually using BetterHelp. Now I have three close personal friends who are using BetterHelp and loving it. BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist, which you can start communicating with them in under 48 hours. So if times are really tough for you right now, I'm saying there is help that is could very quickly be right around the corner. This is not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It is professional counseling done securely online. And there's a broad range of expertise available, which may not be locally available in many areas. The service is available for clients worldwide.
And you could log into your account anytime and send a message to your counselor. You'll get a timely and thoughtful response. Plus, you could schedule weekly video or phone sessions so you won't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room as with traditional therapy. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change counselors if needed. It's more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid is available. BetterHelp wants to help you start living a happier life today.
And here's another interesting, cool thing about BetterHelp. On their website, they have a tab right at the top where you can read reviews of different therapists. And, you know, this can help you find someone. This can just maybe help you get more comfortable with the idea of using a service like this. Here's one example that I found interesting. This is a review for Kathy. Kathy is intuitive and a great listener. One of the things that I appreciate the most is the versatility of her solutions, such as articles, exercises, and meditation. I like that a lot because, you know, there's more to it. You know, it's good to stretch, I guess. So you can visit betterhelp.com/storm. That is H-E-L-P. And join the over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they are recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. So do not forget to go to betterhelp.com/storm, and our listeners can get 10% off their first month. That is betterhelp.com/storm.
It's 2020. Don't wait. Go now. Do it. All right, now is the time on the podcast where we love to thank our Patreon subscribers at the $10 level or above. These are the folks who can listen to Dave Chen and me talk about Lovecraft Country. What else could you want in life? Anyway, so we've got a bunch of new folks we would like to thank. Dennis Yen, Brandon Turner, Joy Novak, Jasmine Levy, Diana Byrne, Jenna Clark, Rex Lorenzo, James Stout, Catherine Puey, Time Traveler Creative, Rosemary, Christina Rudy, TLS, Benjamin Kreischbalmer, Shauna Evans, Sandra, Ben Miller, Casey Schonbrunn, so pretty, Amber Plotch, and Jennifer Holloway.
And I have some people to thank as well. Thank you, Daniel Keeling, SM, Eric Stratton, Rona, Raquel Azvedo McKenney, Jessica Caposi, Lisa Beauregard, Sydney, Aaron, Kate Whitney, Miranda Lane, Abby Bateman, maybe just one Bateman, I'm going to say Abby Bateman, Victoria Yoder, Carolyn, Rajiv Dasani, Lori Bonar, Shannon Black, Isabel Hazel, Roundtree Jones, Tiffany Flowers, and Charlotte Daly, Daly? Charlotte Daly.
The Daly?
Daly.
No, I don't know.
And I would like to thank the following fine humans: Sean Ambrolt, Dan Allen, Susan Flanagan, Christina Brosius, Rachel Fisher Bramble, Monty Cross, Susan Kustush. Yeah, okay, close enough. Danielle Shepherd, Spencer Howard, Susan P., Amy Meek, lovely Miss Jenna, Nick Mendoza, Elizabeth Stellner, Ainsley Clark, Shauna Drake Kelleher, Avendel? Yeah, okay. We'll get there. Rebecca, Nicole Capus, and Natalie Olivas. Thank you all very much.
And we're back for the storm. A loose storm, I promised, but I don't know what that necessarily means. What I do know is we're in our last episode without a John Locke antagonist check-in. The drought is almost over. We're almost to the brig. Praise John Locke. Jacob. Praise Jacob.
Although
the tomato
this is this is another good week for a Juliet antagonist check-in, because I think the ending of this episode is fascinating.
Yeah.
Right. She goes, I hate you.
Right. They're starting to reveal, I guess, the show. Yeah. I mean, the show's starting to reveal Juliet's.
Well, just when you're like that's just, that's classic Juliet, right? You're like, oh man, this bitch is here, like manipulating pregnant women. I don't mean bitch. I never mean that about Juliet. Like, this lady's here, you know, doing experiments on pregnant ladies. She's gonna go after Kate next. Ugh, she's working for the, oh, she hates Ben though. I mean, we already knew that, but now we know it again, and we're just never sure where she stands and what's going on. What's going on, Juliet?
Is Juliet the antagonist here? I actually think she's more helpful in this episode than hurtful, but,
yeah, this is one of the episodes that in my mind, after season six ends, is like, oh, and remember when like Juliet and Sun had their moment where they got to be friends? I kind of blanked out that we were still in the middle of, is Juliet like still evil? Like, I knew, because, you know, I knew like her ultimate goal was to check on the pregnancies, but I'd kind of forgotten about the tape recorder moment. Cause like, in retrospect, you're just like, oh yeah. And then Juliet and Sun, they bonded over ultrasound.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, oh, eventually Juliet just becomes part of the gang, and she's the character that we all love. But I also think I forgot a little bit of this, and it makes sense, because as we talked about in the calm, we're in this part of season three where they're trying to bring the others, the conflict of the others versus the beach survivors mm-hmm. back into the fore, so that we can get to that big finale.
Run over with a van.
Right, exactly. So I think it works really well here to continue to like muddy the water around Juliet for our calmies, because I think it only makes it stronger later when you're just like, yeah, Juliet, she rules. She's the best. She's one of the best characters for sure. Yeah.
I've always liked this episode, but having watched the ending of Lost like a couple times recently, I like was weeping during this sonogram moment, because you know mm-hmm. they revisit it in the finale. This is like the waking up moment where Juliet's there and Sun and Jin in the flash sideways hospital before the vending machine mm-hmm. and it's such a moment in the finale, and so I just like felt that reverberate back into here, and I gotta wonder, like, you know, I don't know how much we talked about it at the time we did the anniversary episode, and we'll certainly talk about it when we get to the series finale. But it must have been fun to have a brainstorming session of like, you know, what are all the things that we can echo back through into this finale? You know what I mean? Like, so one of our listeners is rewatching starting again from the beginning, and she just got to Claire giving birth. Like the first time it happens in the show in season one, and like watching Claire give birth with Kate there and stuff like that is so much more emotional once you know the ending. And I think that's true of this scene. It's so much more emotional once you know where we're headed with that flash sideways moment. So,
well, it also clears it up to be more emotional, because I think I at least struggled with this in the calm. It's like she's not going to die on the island. I just know that in the back of my brain. So it's hard for me to be like, but she's in danger from secret pregnancy disease. Cause I'm like, eh.
I do.
Well,
the only thing I would say is that I do remember the first time around with Lost when it was airing, being very concerned for Sun.
Yeah.
And like being like, oh, Sun's kind of not like a main character in this show. I mean, she is by the end, but I remember being like, oh man, if they're going to kill a main character, like,
yeah, maybe they're thinking I'm going to kill Charlie.
It sucks, but it makes sense.
Well, no, but that's what I'm saying. Yeah. Like, I think once Charlie dies at the end of the season, Charlie, who feels like much more of a main character than he ever actually mm-hmm. was, and Charlie, who was a fan favorite, despite how we feel about Charlie now, it's going to feel much more like all bets are off, and we could kill a pregnant woman if we wanted to. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, people are going to be worried, really worried about Sun, and you are worried about Sun. Like, the whole tension of, like, who made it up, makes it off the island, and you're trying to do this math, you know, with the flash forwards and the freighter drama and all that sort of stuff, as you try to, you know, like, it's so, we're going to get there soon, but like the Oceanic Six and like trying to do that. You're like, does Aaron count? Who are the six? You know, it's like a Battlestar Galactica, like, who are the secret Cylons? You're like trying to figure out every week who are the six.
And I forgot that we get with the freighter, we also get the Jin.
Yeah.
Jin's death, or
Jin's like death. Fourth fake out death of the series.
So it makes the whole Sun, you know, this, what we see in this episode is Sun being happy with the fact that Jin is the father,
right,
and wanting that to be the thing that keeps, you know, that is for them going forward. And then a couple episodes later, it's just the show is like, well, maybe not. Maybe Jin's dead now.
Maybe.
So it's great.
I think Jin's gone for like a very long time. Like, well, after the freighter blows up, because Jin already like fell off a raft and washed ashore several episodes later. But it's an even longer window once the freighter blows up when you see Jin again. So, you know, they kept people guessing. I mean, I'm sure people knew that Daniel Day Kim was still like signed on for the show or whatever. Anyway,
well, sorry, I mean, maybe after season two, they had some questions, because after, you know, he got back to the camp, they really had nothing for him to do. And then even this season, I feel like once they got back from the other side of the island, I haven't thought of anything that Jin's really done until camping.
How dare you? He helped start the VW van.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Oh, the whole team. Okay, never mind. Jin's fine.
Like, very much like Hurley, Jin gets a lot of like side missions.
Yeah.
But they're good.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all... Jin... Every time Daniel Day Kim is...
Flashes like, those pearly whites.
Part of the gang.
Yeah.
He does something great. I mean, just think about like his reaction after Hurley starts the van.
So
is
good.
One of the more memorable ones. The camping story, and I guess maybe not so much in this episode. Hurley sort of takes the forefront of the comedy in this episode, but it's good to have Jin around.
Well, Jin's
to be without him for a while.
Jin's the one who notices that the phone's probably missing.
The satellite phone. Yeah. And he's like, right. Charlie's like, what could he possibly be yelling about?
Mm-hmm. We also get the mention that... and just the introduction of the satellite phone, which will actually be very important. Like, all the stuff with the satellite phone for the rest of the season and into season 4, because, like, the freighter folks have the satellite phone. It becomes, like, a thing, right? So here's the introduction of our new favorite character, satellite phone.
we got a new MacGuffin. We've moved from hatches to digital satellite phones.
Satellite phones. Wait till Saeed gets his hands on that. What was I going to say about that? Oh, we get mentioned this episode also that Jin was in the army, which I think I often forget because we don't have like a flashback to Jin in the army. So like he's on like who are all our soldiers on the island? It's Saeed and Jin,
Desmond
and Desmond. It's a very militaristic group here on the Island of Mystery. So yeah.
We have some emails to read and prompts from.
We sure do. We sure do, folks. Let's talk about fertility again, shall we? So we got an email last week that was like, the fertility issue on the island didn't start until the incident. A lot of long, complicated questions around fertility when it started. And then I got someone else send me an email saying they thought the fertility issue started when like the Jughead bomb came to the island, and that's in like the 50s, right?
Oh yeah.
But then we got another complicated email from Matthew Wilson, who writes, just wanted to add a quick thought on whether the fertility issues on the island existed before the incident. One thing we know is that the statue of Tawaret, which I could never pronounce correctly, a symbol of fertility, that's the huge statue that's on the island. So there may be an implication.
Of which we've only seen a foot so far.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. I don't think it's until across the sea that we see the thing intact. Mm-hmm. So there may be an implication that some of the ancient islanders also had problems with conceiving on the island, although there's nothing definite on the show to back this up. The Lost Encyclopedia says that the issues of death and fertility remained central to subsequent civilizations, none of which ever gained the kinds of population numbers that would have allowed their further generations to gain any permanency on the island. That would suggest that there were always fertility issues, but perhaps they were made worse by the incident. So,
what a cruel fate. An island that gives you 5 times the sperm and is like, but.
But it kills
it
anyone
kills.
You impregnate with it.
Oh, wow.
Wow. That's the ultimate bad dad move right there.
And then we got a Henry Gale Memorial, most obviously a lie award, piped into us from the future from Carly. And I'm going to read it now because I'm not going to remember this for season 6. But Carly's watching season 6, episode 13. The episode is called The Last Recruit. And Hurley says, hey, Claire, you look great. And then Carly attached a photo of what Claire looks like in season 6, which, as you may recall, Claire's been living rough in the jungle for a while. So Carly says, Hurley wins this award forever. I rest my case. Thanks for your work and don't fall down. So, they gave poor, beautiful Emily DeRaven the, like, kookiest wig you've ever seen in your life. She's got like weird squirrel taxidermy babies. It's not going well for Claire in season 6. So there you go. And then we have an email from a longtime friend of the pod, Pat Spinagle.
Yay, Pat.
And it's about John Locke. So I wanted to give
John Locke.
I wanted to give Dave an early birthday present. Here we go. Pat says, I'm way behind on listening to the Storm podcast, so I apologize. I'm getting caught up, but I wanted to offer this insight I had in regards to the ongoing John Locke discussions. Because people seem to feel very strongly one way or another about John Locke, I would like to suggest that he's the Stannis of Lost.
Ooh.
Oh, God.
Look, I'm not trying to say Stannis and Locke are one-to-one for comparisons, just that people who love Stannis and people who hate Stannis can often agree on everything but... about the character and then still fall on different sides of the pro-Stannis or con-Stannis line. I think that I could go on and on about their similarities, how they both have mystical guidance that might not be in their best interest, how they simultaneously are leader figures while not being given their proper due as they might believe they're entitled to, and both end up doing heroic things and villainous or antagonist-appropriate things, ultimately ending in tragedy. Because I said this would be a short email, I'll leave any further Locke and Stannis considerations up as an exercise to the listener to either validate or refute my assertion. I do know that there are people who hate Stannis and love Locke, and they won't be happy to hear anything like this. That's probably aimed at Grant. That's cool. Hope everyone can use to be well, and I hope to get caught up soon with the podcast. Best regards, and with great affection, Pat from Maryland. So
here's my question for Pat, which I think Pat probably should have seen coming. Are we talking about show Stannis?
No, book Stannis.
Because if it's book Stannis, I think I'm in.
It's true. If it's book John Locke, he's the hero we deserve, right? How are we doing time-wise? Is this the week we tackle another long Grant email, or should we save it?
Let's do it. Why not? I mean, yeah, but also, do we let Locke and Stannis stand? No, yeah, no, we could do it. Let's do a Grant email. Let's wrap it up with everyone. A murderer's row of Storm emails.
The Worst Thing Jacob Did by Grant Piercy.
All right, get some coffee. Here we go.
In your episode on One of Us, you asked what's the worst thing Jacob has ever done. This is an interesting question. Since this is our island deity, the protector of the light at the heart of the island, a little piece of which lives in every person on Earth, it gets us into the big questions. What does it all mean? What's it all for? Why was all this suffering and death necessary? And why would our island deity allow it all to happen if he has supernatural powers to prevent it? This is Lost, leading us to the question of the problem of evil. Before we talk about the problem of evil, let's set the rules for what seems to be happening on the island at its highest level, the gamesmanship between the island god Jacob and its devil, the smoke monster. The season 5 finale and the thrust of season 6 gives us the devil's motivation to kill his opponent Jacob so that he might escape the island. Jacob must defend against Smokey's moves long enough to train a suitable replacement, conceding that Smokey will probably eventually win. But the rule set by the previous island guardian, the mother, prevents Jacob or Smokey from attacking or killing one another directly. Jacob, upon discovering that his brother killed the mother, murders his brother and throws his body into the heart of the island from which the smoke monster erupts. It's clear that Jacob murdered his brother because we have his dead body. What's not clear is why Smokey was created. So I propose that this act is the worst thing that Jacob does, as it somehow results in the creation of his opponent, the devil, who will murder, maim, and corrupt people who come to the island for millennia afterward. Okay, let's analyze this for a second. Did Jacob's brother become the smoke monster entity, or did he corrupt/co-opt something that existed already, an entity that absorbs the brother's memories upon death? We have evidence of this, as he later has Locke's and Christian's memories after their deaths. Or did the mother's rule, which Jacob violated through his heinous act against his brother, somehow prevent Jacob from actually killing him, effectively trapping him on the island as a corrupted, disembodied entity? Answers certainly weren't forthcoming in Across the Sea, which is fine. It's more fun that way. But we did get the sense that the mother, as island guardian, could set some metaphysical rules somehow. So Why did Jacob allow these rules to continue? Why couldn't he set new rules? Why couldn't Jacob disincorporate Smokey, whatever he was, rewrite the rules to allow this entity to expire, let him pass on, escape? Was it just because he needed an opponent, like the Senate game they played as children? In other words, this is the central thesis of Grant's email. Why does God allow the devil to exist? This brings us back to the problem of evil. This is best summarized by philosopher David Hume, whose name you might recognize as the inspiration for Desmond's full name. He summarized an argument presented by Greek philosopher Epicurus thusly. Is God willing to prevent evil but not able? Then he is not omnipotent. Is he able but not willing? Then he is malevolent. Is he both able and willing? Then from whence comes evil? The term for resolving the problem of evil is called a theodicy. I think that's how you pronounce it. So what is Locke's theodicy? What do we know about Jacob? He's the proponent of free will. You have a choice, he tells Ben before his own murder. Still trying to prove me wrong, Smokey accuses when they sit on the beach, to which Jacob responds, you are wrong. What's Smokey wrong about? Quote, they come, they fight, they destroy, they corrupt. It always ends the same. Maybe what he's wrong about is that free will makes man inevitably become evil, slash inflict suffering, slash diminish the light of the island. That in order to obtain grace, which the 815ers do in the end, they have to be free to make choices that result in the greatest good. Despite the nature of fate and Jacob's hand in drawing people to the island, they must be free to make choices once they're on the game board. Even a character like Saeed, who is quote unquote claimed by Smokey, is free to act in defiance of him. In the Sideways world, we see that even someone like Ben, who is not beyond redemption. I'm also curious about the whispers, the souls who are trapped there like Michael. He's there because of what he did, but is that permanence or penance? Some philosophers do indeed think that the resolution to the problem of evil is indeed the existence of free will, that grace cannot be obtained without character building, courage, love, and contemplating truth, which means it can't be obtained without suffering. What else do we know about Jacob? He appears to care about his candidates, apologizing when they are hurt, such as when he touches Locke after being pushed from the building by Cooper, and wishing them luck. He also thinks people should not be told what to do, as he elaborated with Richard. Richard responds, but if you brought them here, why didn't you help them? And Jacob says, because I wanted them to help themselves, to know the difference between right and wrong without me having to tell them. It's all meaningless if I have to force them to do anything. Why should I have to step in? And then Richard says, if you don't, I will. All right, we're in the home stretch here. All right. This is almost like an establishment of church. The sacred words must be handed down to provide guidelines for how to act because the devil doesn't follow the same rules that Jacob does, and our island deity simply never thought of that. One of the problems with being an all-powerful, isolated deity is you don't have anyone to tell you you're wrong or your ideas are shit, except, of course, the devil. I also think back to the book club at the beginning of season 3 when one of the others accuses Carrie of being by the numbers religious hokum. I feel like Lost's metaphysics are slightly more complex, even if this might be Damon's way of poking fun at his own work self-referentially. We have a D&D alignment chart of character types in the show, and nobody seems all good, and maybe only Kimi and Anthony Cooper seem all bad. The arguments around theodicy usually center on who is ultimately responsible for the creation of evil or the allowance of suffering. Is this God's fault, man's fault for the fall? And to bring that back around, in Lost, Jacob is directly responsible for the evil he unleashed on the creation of the smoke in the creation of the smoke monster. It's like Batman being responsible for the creation of the Joker and then allowing the Joker to live all these years because it's against the rules to kill him. At some level, does Lost's deity deserve some culpability in all that follows after the smoke monster's creation, if he has the power to stop it? Especially since we know there's another way to run things, as Ben says to Hurley in the end. I hope this discussion has been somewhat enlightening. As always, thank you for all you do in analyzing the hell out of the show. And also thank you for having me as a guest a few weeks ago. It was such an insane honor and a complete delight. See you in another life, Grant. So I did warn you. Anyway, I think this is great. I think it's brilliant. I think I love how messy a god Jacob is. And it really speaks to, I think of, this moment in The Leftovers, no major spoilers for The Leftovers, I think, but there's this moment in The Leftovers when Nora, the character played by Carrie Coon, is like crawling up a hill and it's raining and she's trying to get these beads off the neck of this goat, and it's this whole like, and she like takes the beads, she puts the beads on herself because she's like taking on the suffering, and it's like this whole thing, and it's just like, what God would allow this? Is a question I think Damon likes to ask a lot in his work. Carlton seems less preoccupied with this. And so I think making Jacob so messy and imperfect and immature and shitty sometimes is one of Lost's many stabs at brilliance. I don't know. Do you guys have any reaction to Grant's email?
No, I like all of it. I think there's a big tension in like Jacob, you know, creating the smoke monster out of murder, and then he continues to treat it like his brother, which I think we talked about earlier, probably also from Grant, but maybe just from other people, about the smoke monster being part of the light that has been exposed to the pain of humanity. And so I think almost like if it would have not presented as being his brother, I think the question of if you let evil exist would have been much more black and white for Jacob, the god who seems to want to have control sometimes and not have control sometimes. But since I think the most traumatizing event in his life is when he killed his brother, he will go about, he will keep up with his mother's rules just to not do that again. And so it's almost like his personal fear that stops him from like this grand experiment. He would rather have his brother as an opponent, like Grant suggested. And I don't think he necessarily sees it as letting evil exist. But it's, yeah, interesting. I like all of it.
Do we think, I guess this is a question that we'll we'll get to, but could Jacob have killed the smoke monster?
Well, I mean, that's
if he wanted
that's
to.
That's one of Grant's points, is like, it seems like the mother set certain rules.
Yeah.
But then, like, Jacob sets his own rules to a certain degree. And then at the end of the series, Ben's like, yeah, that's how Jacob ran it, but Hurley, you don't have to do it that way. And so the idea is like, you don't have to. And maybe that's just something only Ben would think of. Maybe Jacob mm-hmm. would be like, well, mom set the rules, so these are the rules.
Well, yeah.
And Ben's like, I found a loophole, which is...
it's not my mom.
It's like in Hamilton when Thomas Jefferson's like, you're not going to be my vice president because guess what? I'm the president. You know what I mean? It's like, mm-hmm. I'm the boss now. And I don't think Hurley would have thought of that. I don't think Hurley would have thought to change the rules. But you need a Ben to be like, who says you have to follow those rules? Those are the old rules. These are road rules. You know what I mean? Like, so, yeah.
Yeah.
What I think,
I mean, I think there's also something really interesting to be said about the way Lost handles individualism versus communalism, especially when Grant is talking about Jacob's desire to see the humans on the chessboard make the right choice on their own. I feel like sometimes that's the choice he's wanting him to make, is like, we could work together and we could, you know, be good, right? We could work together. We could solve problems. It's only when we're doing things on our own. It's only when we're like Ben and we're just dictating out to everyone and we're saying, this is the way, these are the rules, I'm the guy in charge, that things start to go wrong. I don't know. There's more to that theory that I'm going to have to put together as we get through the last couple seasons here.
Well, I also think it's worth thinking about in the final season. In the final season, some of the things that the people, our heroes, do for the on-island plot is a little confusing. In terms of like who, like what they're doing around this devil that's wearing Locke's face. And I think mm-hmm. one way to explain, I mean, obviously, like, the Smokey has some, like, powers of persuasion that can't be underestimated. But I think also, if we think about Jacob being unwilling to consider that this person wearing his brother's face is not in some way his brother, then you have a similar conflict of our survivors being like, I know that's, you know, they keep saying this to each other, that's not John Locke. And they'll go, oh, I know. You know, like Sawyer will be like, I know. And Sawyer has plans that he's working and Sawyer's like doing some stuff. But like at the same time, I think they still have trouble on some level not understanding that that's not John Locke. And it's only when Jack is like, you disrespect his memory, that Jack is able to divorce the specter of John Locke from this malevolent creature, right?
Yeah.
Something that Jacob was never able to do with his own brother, that this thing wearing his brother's face, right?
Yeah.
So, like, this thing that wears his brother's face says, like, I hate you. You know what I mean? And that just sounds like, and he's like, I know, you know, and like, that just sounds like something a brother would say, not like, you know, a disembodied critter. I don't know. It's interesting.
Well, there's the whole, like...
No, this is good stuff.
There's the whole twist of, like... Oh, no, never mind. I'm not going to say the twist of the Preacher comics. But there's a whole question that is attached to, like, this, why does God allow evil to exist? That is sort of based around the idea of benevolence or malevolence, where, like, I think the scarier idea is, what if it's, like... They kind of don't care. What if humans choosing good just pleases the gods because you chose them, I guess, is the complicating thing.
That's the whole question of Job, right? Like, what kind of God would put Job through all of that just to win a bet with the devil? You know what I mean?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like Job is more interested in God in the story of Job. My interpretation of the story of Job is that God is more interested in proving to the devil he's right than he is in the emotional well-being of Job.
Yes.
Right.
And that's fucked up. But that's the Old Testament God.
It's kind of a dick move.
And Jacob's definitely an Old Testament God. You know what I mean? That's why in Trading Places, which is a Job story, they're both the devil. You know what I mean? Like, it's not God and the devil make a bet. It's two rich assholes make a bet. Because you can't, like, in our understanding of a God, of a deity, of a protector of light, we can't think of someone like that putting Job through all the things that Job goes through. And basically, everyone who comes to the island is a Job character. Yeah,
and it's less justified in this situation because Jacob doesn't have control over an afterlife. He's going to boost your sperm count by 5 times. Like, I'm not willing to go through endless suffering to have a higher sperm count. Maybe if I got into heaven after I died, I'd be able to feel a little better about being tested while I was on Earth. But what the fuck, Jacob? Like, just more sperm? That's what I get? But not worth it. Leave me out of your candidacy. I've got things to deal with in Colorado. It is snowing while things are burning down.
So Jacob's a dick.
Yeah, Jacob's a dick. Okay. I think it tracks. I think
in this universe, God sucks.
In this universe, God it sucks.
And the devil's kind of reasonable, except for the part where he wants to, like,
down a hole.
Yeah, like the devil. The thing about the smoke monster is so interesting is like everything. He says, I mean, and this is a classic devil move, seems really reasonable and fine. He just wants to leave so that he could die. But we keep hearing that if he gets off the island, everyone, but we only have Jacob's word for it, that like everyone you love will die. But then, like, you know, the smoke monster does some really shicey stuff involving blowing up people we like. So, you know, we probably can't trust him either. I don't know, guys.
He also steals Saeed's soul at some point. Or inhabit Saeed's
body. That's some like complicated temple mumbo jumbo that I do not understand.
We'll come back to that.
Guess what we get to start poking into next week? Some mumbo jumbo. Neil, where are we going for Lost?
Well, Dave, I am happy to report to you in particular that John Locke is returning next week in The Brig. You know this because you're hosting Saturday Night's Live Watch in our Slack. All the people in the storm know this because we're in the storm. But it's The Brig. John Locke is back.
John Locke is back. And so is Cooper. And so is Sawyer. Things are going
to
be.
I am excited to see how our Calmies navigate the Anthony Cooper thing. Like, how do we feel about that?
I think it's going to be fun. So. And then 2 weeks from now, they will do what I think I did and I think Joanna did. Which is just assume the Anthony Cooper stuff all happens in one episode. Because I remember that's how it feels. Where it's like, oh yeah, he's on the island, and then he's in the brig, and it's like, oh well, I forgot there are like 4 weeks of Juliet antagonist in between those two things.
It's true.
But yeah, and then we're back next week with more John Locke. We're into it. Until then, Rick. Oh, good.
And a great Josh Holloway.
And a great Josh Holloway. Just a good episode of Lost. And then I think it's all Gangbusters season 3 from here on out. So until then, where could people find more of your work online? Let's start this week with Neil Miller.
Well, you know, you can get me at filmschoolrejects.com on Twitter at rejects or at One Perfect Shot. That one's also pretty good. You can also, don't forget to follow our show at Storm Podcast, vote in our polls and join us. We just finished the Slack Watch of Black Sails, and they're maybe a new show at some point. Stay tuned.
And Joanna Robinson.
Oh, you can find me on VanityFair.com. I'm back on the podcast Little Gold Men. We're firing up the podcast Still Watching with Richard Lawson over there on VF.com. So yeah, it's podcast season again, baby. Or you can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can follow me on Twitter at DA7E, or you can listen to me on the Fighting in the War Room podcast, where this week we talk about Mulan, and I'm thinking about ending things. And always here, every week, talking to you about Lost, and reminding you to not fall down. It's very important. Stay upright. See you next week.